Welcome to Behavioral Grooves. My name is Kurt Nelson.
And I'm Tim Houlihan. Behavioral Grooves is on a mission to share conversations with great researchers, astute practitioners, brilliant authors, and accidental behavioral scientists in ways that you won't hear anywhere else.
Like the way our guest for this episode spoke about employee engagement and how many companies are ignoring a huge problem.
So think about it. Would we ever let our websites be down 70% of the time or let our hotels only be 70% occupied, and yet we let our workforce be 70% disengaged?
That was the voice of Susan Hunt Stevens, and this is one of many important questions we discussed during our conversation with her. Susan is the founder and CEO of WeSpire, a technology platform that connects employees to an organization's unique mission and values in ways that help them achieve the company's goals. WeSpire delivers applications at scale, including programs supporting diversity and inclusion, so that employees are recognized for shaping a welcoming community both inside and outside the firm.
We talked to Susan about her observations on the value of building diverse teams, the creation of a psychologically safe workplace, and most importantly, about the ethical application of behavioral science in our lives. Susan's insightful comments come from a mix of her passion for the application of good research and her desire to help build productive, profitable organizations that treat their people with respect.
We want to give a special shout out to Emily Wagner. Now, she is a regular listener to Behavioral Grooves, and she totally turned us on to Susan's passions, insights, and the work that she's doing at WeSpire. So thank you, Emily. We are grateful for your recommendation. And Susan radiates optimism about the future, whether it's virtual or in a shared space, and we're excited to share that.
We also find that practitioners bring an important perspective to the podcast. Susan is definitely familiar with the literature, but in her work to serve clients, she needs to find the quickest, most efficient ways to assess situations and develop solutions. For example, Susan uses a simple 7-question survey to assess the levels of psychological safety within an organization. Her efficient and practical nature is to be admired.
And after you listen to this conversation that we had with Susan, Kurt and I will groove a bit and offer some after-the-moment thoughts on what we covered with her. Then we'll close with a bonus track and a groove idea. So we're mentioning it now so that you can stick around for it.
With that, we encourage you to sit back with a fine glass of psychological safety and ethics and enjoy our conversation with Susan Hunt Stevens.
Welcome to Behavioral Grooves, Susan Hunt Stevens.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We are glad to have you here. And we're going to get started really quickly with a speed round. Kurt, do you want to start or should I start?
No, I'll start. So do you prefer coffee or tea?
Tea.
Okay. Would you rather have dinner with your favorite sports star or favorite musician?
Musician.
You're already two of Tim's favorite, you know, he's like, he doesn't drink coffee and he's the musician. So yeah, you're doing a good job.
It's with the double bonus bundle right now.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah.
Would you rather learn a new instrument or a new language?
An instrument.
Okay. Three for three with Tim. So you are just, you're nailing it.
I know which instrument. I would love to learn how to play the fiddle.
The fiddle. Okay, so this is supposed to be a speed round, but we're going to take a break here. Okay. What about a fiddle makes that the preferred instrument over a guitar or piano or saxophone or whatever other potential instrument is out there? Fiddle.
Yes. I'm an Irish step dancer. I'm learning. I'm an intermediate dancer. And the fiddle just seems to be the instrument that brings, you know, the most fun dances, especially reels, to life. And it would just be so fun to be able to not only dance, but to play. Bars in Ireland.
Bars in Ireland. Oh, there you go. It brings it all around. There you go.
Totally.
There was a story behind that.
We have lots more conversations ahead of us here, Susan. I just wanted to say, because bars in Ireland, I've got great stories to talk about there as well. Okay, so last speed round question. Are teams more productive when they're more diverse or when they're more similar?
When they're more diverse.
Okay, good. That's great, because that's what we want to start talking about. Why is that? Why is a team more productive when it's got more diverse individuals on it? And you might also want to talk about what that diversity means.
So what the research has shown is that teams with more diverse members perform better, whether that board of directors or teams that are building new products. And I think it's because everyone brings a unique perspective that is able to see both problems and opportunities from a different lens and can bring that differing expertise and perspective to finding better solutions. And so some of the most exciting research is what happens on boards when you have diverse perspectives on boards. And there are now actually investment funds that are looking at investing in companies with diverse boards and leadership teams. And those investment funds perform better than those that don't take diversity as a screening criteria.
That's fascinating. So when you think about the boards, what is the unique quality of boards that lends itself to having the impact that diversity does when you're thinking about boards? Is there something unique there?
Well, so I think boards are charged with a strategy first and foremost, and making sure that the business is strategy. When you think about the importance of strategy, it's looking longer term, it's thinking about risk, it's thinking about opportunity, and that requires innovation, as well as a more, frankly, diverse set of perspectives to see the pros and cons of different decisions. I also think boards are often asked to handle very complex decision-making, and complex decisions are, you make better decisions in complex decisions when you have a diverse range of perspectives about what could go well and what could go wrong. You're not getting that sort of single track thought that can often send a company or a group of people into a ultimately bad direction.
So help us understand what you mean by diversity. Are we talking about like diverse being like a 35-year-old white guy and a 55-year-old white guy?
Well, diversity can depend on a lot of different factors, depending on what the majority of the organization is. In general, on boards, you do not have as much perspective from women and underrepresented minorities. So in the case of corporate boards, when you say diversity, you are often talking about gender and race.
Great.
Now, in leadership teams, that can be very different. If you have a school that primarily has women teachers, or you have a hospital with primarily nurses, you may find yourself in a place where the majority is actually women and the diversity you need to bring in is men. And so what you are thinking about is, how does this organization reflect the society that it is serving and representing? And if that organization isn't representing the society that it is serving, then it has a lack of diversity inherently in its structure, irrespective of race or gender. And I think what has evolved, however, in most cases, certainly the tech industry that I work in, but boards of directors, finance organizations, is that generally, when you are speaking about diversity, you are speaking about, is there a 50-50 equity, you know, representation in terms of gender? And given the U.S. population ranges in different states, different areas, in terms of minority representation, but in some states is majority minority, does your board reflect that? And that's what you should be aiming at, is really thinking about, does my organization reflect, you know, the world that I am serving, living in, and part of?
Yes. And how difficult is that when you're tasked, when your company is tasked with this? Are these pretty simple things to figure out and implement solutions around, or is there a lot of friction in making them happen, or is it just hard work?
Well, certainly we have been working on the issues of gender and racial equity for years, and in some cases not making much progress. So by default, I would say this is clearly an entrenched, challenging problem that we've been trying to solve, and in some cases are solving it better than we used to, and in some cases making no progress. As a practitioner who works with organizations to help to uncover what is driving or hindering success in the areas of diversifying leadership in particular, and diversifying employee base, I would tell you that it is certainly not impossible. It is very, very doable to do so. And it's not as hard as sometimes people make it out to be. But it does require consistent attention over time. And I think what happens is a lot of organizations make an effort for a short period of time to do one or two different programs to try to solve the problem, and then are surprised when 12 to 24 months later, this problem that's existed for years and years and years isn't solved. And the most successful organizations that we've seen who have embraced diversity and have really made it part of their culture and their values and have been successful are those that have really taken a systemic, long-range approach and who also have set very often at the time seemingly audacious targets and then measured consistently how they're doing against those targets, but have stayed the course even when it got hard. And so, you know, it's I would tell any board of directors, you can absolutely achieve gender equity in your organization. You can absolutely achieve racial diversity, equity in your organization, but you have to be committed to it and you have to work on it for a long time. And most importantly, what we've found in our work is you really have to start to uncover what is standing in the way of people who are in the minority being successful. And this is where some of the most exciting work that we've done has emerged.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, because I think that it parlays itself out into, I think, a lot of the conversations that are going across the country right now, given George Floyd and everything else that has gone with just the systematic biases that we have and some of the systemic elements that are going on with that. And it seems to be, as you mentioned, this idea that, hey, if you look at corporate boards across America, just, you know, did a quick Google search, under, you know, 25% of corporate boards are women on board. So that's definitely not representative. And yet we know we've been focusing on this for a long time. So there's something going on beyond some of the, you know, first level of looking at this. There's some probably underlying aspects. And so we'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I'm going to start with the two aspects that are most important to understand as to why inequity exists. And the first is that there are policies and practices that have entrenched inequities without people even realizing it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things you have to do when you're going to tackle any form of equitable workplace is to understand which policies and practices are affecting equity the most and start to really attack those policies and practices. The other is to understand that inequities happen due to behavior and that there are things that people do to each other, often without understanding or having any conscious awareness of it, that creates a sense of psychological safety in the workplace. And what has been fascinating about our work is that without intending to stumble upon psychological safety being key to diversity, equity, and success, we did. And so what we had been doing is working with organizations to understand when women and underrepresented minorities in those organizations succeeded, why did they succeed? When they didn't succeed, why didn't they succeed? And what were similar and different for those that did succeed? And we took a very data-driven approach. We interviewed dozens of people in the organization to get hypotheses around this. And these were confidential interviews where they could say whatever they thought, and collected hundreds of hypotheses and then tested those hypotheses to be able to rule in and rule out what was driving success. And the hypotheses fell into three categories. The first were demographic. There were things about a person's education or background or age or, you know, where they were raised or what school they went to or whether they were an athlete, you know, things like that, that people thought drove success. Well, then there was a whole category that was sort of tied into the business itself. They worked for this manager or they were with this client or they had this training or they had this, you know, sponsor or mentor or things like that, what we would call situational. And then the third category all fell into things around behavior. They're extroverted. They're, you know, analytical. They are this in Clifton Strengths or Myers-Briggs or, you know, just how they behave. And what was fascinating was for this, you know, very large consulting firm that we worked with on this, we were able to rule out, because of the great work they had done already before we got there, almost all the major hypotheses. There was no statistically significant difference between women, underrepresented minorities, and men on the vast majority. So being a college athlete had nothing to do with whether women succeeded or not, you know, and say, no, that actually didn't. We found one pretty big demographic finding, which was a policy practice finding. And then we found psychological safety, and the varying levels of psychological safety is the other really key finding. So just because it's fascinating, I'll tell you what the demographic finding was.
Thank you, because I'm sitting here going, what was that?
So if you had a stay-at-home spouse, irregardless of your gender, if you had a stay-at-home spouse, you were more successful than people who did not have a stay-at-home spouse. So that, of course, raised all sorts of policies and practices questions for this business. Like, why have we structured it so you basically have to have somebody staying at home for the other person to be successful? And what they realized is that what was manifesting right now as a gender equity problem was actually going to become a generational problem. Because when you looked below at the group that was coming up through the organization, this is a very pyramid-oriented organization, many had partners with equal roles. And the conversations that we were hearing was that I'm going to have to change jobs because it's not fair for me to ask my partner who is a surgeon to not work just so that I can be gone Monday through Thursday doing this kind of consulting work, you know, and things like that. And so they had to really rethink kind of how this is all going to work to tackle that issue. But the other issue that popped was this very, very significant difference in psychological safety. And for those people not familiar with the concept of psychological safety, Amy Edmondson, a professor from the Harvard Business School, did some really groundbreaking research around this in the late 90s. But it's essentially the ability to bring your whole self to work and not feel like you're going to be penalized or hurt or humiliated for your ideas, your suggestions, and your thoughts. The reason psychological safety has really risen in the last probably 4 to 5 years is something companies are paying a lot of attention to was because of Project Aristotle, which Google did, where they were doing the same kind of research work of trying to figure out what drove the highest performing teams. And what they found were the highest performing teams were those with the highest levels of psychological safety. So the implication for diversity, equity, and inclusion work is actually kind of exciting from my standpoint, which is to have high performing teams, you need high levels of psychological safety. If then you are looking at your organization and you have vast discrepancies in psychological safety between groups for any reason whatsoever, whether that's gender or race-based groups, or whether that's age-based groups, or whether that's which country they're working in based groups, you will have performance issues relative to if you had everybody the same. So if you can work to strengthen psychological safety broadly for the whole company, you are not only going to increase performance, but you will likely increase the success of those people who had lower psychological safety. And at least the vast majority of research and that we've done with companies, we have found that often women and underrepresented minorities have lower levels of psychological safety. And so if you can improve that, what we would hope to see play out over time is that the company's going to perform better and you will retain and promote and grow your women and underrepresented minorities more. And so back to, you know, what do I advise if you're trying to create a more equitable organization? Of course, you want to do all the things that we've known for years about, you know, developing a good talent pipeline and making sure that you're doing all the things you should be doing in the recruiting process to have equity in the hiring and equitable promoting and all these things. But I do believe that focusing on psychological safety is something that we have not seen as a key aspect of what you should do to improve diversity and inclusion. And if we can make those two links, everyone wins.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that link before. And so I think that's really exciting to see the research that points to the, you know, the connection between the two, because if that can be, it goes back again to what we were talking about earlier. Some of those, we've been trying to do different programs and processes in order to improve the stuff for many years, and it just doesn't seem to be working. And so obviously we're missing something. And if this is that link, that missing link per se, then we've accomplished something. So I'm going to ask more of a tactical question here. So if people are listening to this and they're leaders in a company and they're going, okay, sounds great, I want to do that, how do I go about improving psychological safety inside of my workplace? What are some of the tips and tactics?
Well, the first thing you have to do is figure out how is your psychological safety in your organization. So the first thing you have to do is do a psychological safety assessment and to figure out, do you have high levels of psychological safety? Is it the same across the board? Are there unique differences depending on different factors? And to test those hypotheses and to figure that out. And that's really, I find that to be some of the most rewarding, eye-opening work that we do, is when we're able to show a company and say, look, overall, your psychological safety is here, and here's how that compares to other companies we've worked with. But here's where you're strong, because there's 7 different dimensions of psychological safety. So you might be really strong in, mistakes not being held against people, but really, weak in risk taking, for example. And so where are you strong? Where are you weak? And then, on those hypotheses of what's driving psychological safety, can you rule some of them out? No, that's not having any impact. Are there some where it's like, oh my goodness, yes, our young people feel much safer than our older people, or our women feel less safe than our men? And you find those things. Once you find those things, then you have to kind of ask yourself, okay, is this a policy practice problem, or is this a behavior problem? And that's where you get into, what do we do about it? So I'll give you some insights as examples that can help bring this to life. So we found in a client, for example, that one of the things that affected psychological safety was the prevalence of after hours social events. And many employees that did not feel able to attend those or didn't enjoy them. Anyway, and when you looked at who couldn't attend and who didn't enjoy them, they felt much less psychologically safe than the rest of the organization. Now, that does not mean you should cancel all after hours social events as a workplace. But what you need to understand is that an after hours social event is not meeting the needs of all your employees and isn't giving you the ability to connect, network, and do all the beautiful things that back, when we used to be able to meet in person, we could do. But you need to think about, how do I do this in a way that's more inclusive? And so maybe as a leader, instead of coming to town and just having dinner with folks, you have a sign-up opportunity for people to have a breakfast with you, a lunch with you, or a dinner with you. And that's a practice that you could do that enables everyone to go irrespective of their schedule, or at least to flex around it. And that's a practice you could change. On the behavioral side, as somebody who will wiggle my pen back and forth or flip my foot a ton in an organization, I didn't know that that's sending a message of hurry up, I'm tired of listening to you, get to the point. And if somebody is sitting there having a conversation with me and I'm doing those things, completely not realizing they're not feeling safe in that conversation. They're not feeling respected or listened to, it's like, I can't be bothered, which is not how I'm trying to make people feel. But if I'm not cognizant of how certain aspects of my body language, one I think we all face is laptops. And so one of the things that they have found is meetings where everybody's on their laptop typing things create psychological safety issues for some of the people in the room, not everybody, but some, because they don't feel listened to, not paying attention. So for example, we went to a laptops closed, practice in our company all hands meetings after learning that people being on their laptops and typing things was making a lot of people just feel not respected or listened to or any of that. And it's this little thing that you don't think would be important, but it's a behavior that you have to teach.
Yeah, it's really I remember the very first time I was doing some work. Actually, it was with Microsoft. And I went in, I was presenting, 30 people in the room, 28 of them pulled out laptops and opened them up as I'm presenting for 45 minutes. And it was the first time that I'd had that happen. And it was just, discombobulating. I didn't know how, are they paying attention? Am I boring them? Because every once in a while they'd look up, but then they go back down. And so it's very different. So I'm one of those people that is probably on that side where that, you open up your laptop and that conversation with me. Now that was many years ago. And I think it's become more, common, and so I've adjusted my
and
my
you've own become more jaded.
I've become more jaded. That could be too.
Exactly. Another one that we don't think about, but when you're in a meeting and you're with a group and the group is making a decision, some people are perfectly comfortable jumping in with their thoughts about the decision. Other people just never will. So as a leader, what you should do when a decision is being made is go around the room and ask everybody, we're making this decision. How are you feeling about that? And solicit their thoughts. And that's something that is a psychologically safe decision-making practice that helps those people who aren't naturally loudmouths and comfortable, jumping in a conversation, not dominate the decision-making. Yeah. And it may turn out that the very quiet, very thoughtful person who would not have said anything actually is the one who brings up the most salient, critical thing the rest of the room hadn't thought of. But if not given the opportunity to speak, by welcoming the person to speak, they wouldn't have said a thing.
Yeah. It sounds to a degree like you need to be a good facilitator, right? A good facilitator training are those people who look, make sure everybody's engaged, make sure everybody's feeling like they're contributing and that they can be heard. All of those kind of factors that go into being a good facilitator probably go into making a good leader to be psychologically safe.
Absolutely. Also, things like we've found in some of our research that last minute work creates a lack of psychological safety for a decent number of people. And so being a manager who effectively plans so you aren't always throwing things at your team at the last minute can have a huge impact on psychological safety. Being open and authentic about your own failures, that's something that's almost terrifying to do in the workplace and not something you would think of as a really good management or leadership practice. Wait, share all the times I failed? But if you want your organization to take risks and know it's okay to fail, if you're not sharing your own failures, how can you expect people to feel like it's okay to fail? And so these are practices and behaviors that if you can not only identify are important and reinforce doing and then create a culture around that, you're going to improve the behavioral aspect of psychological safety in addition to dismantling some of those practices and procedures that are creating barriers you might not have even known existed.
I think about it from the perspective of behavioral science, we know that humans have biases and blind spots. And to what degree do you need to overcome individual, especially leadership, blind spots of, well, that's not me. That doesn't apply to me. Whatever they're talking about, that's really not me. I'm good about this or that, or I treat everybody really well, or whatever kind of rationalization that we're so good at, that we are really super effective rationalizers. To what degree do you encounter that in your work, Susan? And how do you overcome it, by the way?
Yeah. So certainly we encounter people who have never been given the gift of 360 feedback. Having 360 feedback in an organization is a commitment and is a process. And what we tend to find is that you will often have been getting feedback from your superiors, but not necessarily your peers or your subordinates. And so you have a very skewed perspective of your performance because it's only coming from one direction versus coming from others. And so unless you have an organization that has a really good 360 degree feedback process, you are going to have blind spots about your performance and what you do. So I think 360s are actually an extraordinarily effective way for people to reduce their blind spots. We also hear that psychological safety is affected based on the quality of the feedback. So just because you're getting the feedback, if the quality isn't good, and how to give good feedback, how often are people taught that? it's not as common as you would hope or think, and given how often we do have opportunities to give feedback. So certainly the other way to help ensure on your team that you are getting good feedback from peers and the people who work for you and, you know, and who you work for is you have to ask for it first and foremost. But the other thing is make sure people have been taught how to give good feedback. The easiest thing is to be like, you're doing great. You know, that's not helpful.
That's what I always tell Tim, you know, hey, you're doing great. Good job. Keep it up. All right.
Exactly. But how
it's working.
Yeah, exactly. How, you know, and so when I think about behavior change and we're big proponents and adherents have designed our whole platform around BJ Fogg's methodology for behavior change. You know, I think it's such a simple framework to help understand what you have to do when you're trying to motivate and inspire any sort of behavior change is first and foremost, increase people's ability to do what it is you want them to do. Then you have to increase their motivation to do it. And then when those two things are optimized, figure out what are the nudges and the triggers for that to happen. And so just training people on how to give good feedback, okay, that's great. That increases their ability. But now what's their motivation to do it? And what's the nudge or trigger that gets them to do it? That's actually one of the things I worry about with moving away from the annual performance review, which I don't think was the most beautiful concept in the entire world, but it was a nudge and a trigger. Mm-hmm. It was built into every year. And what we hear from employees is when companies make a transition away from that annual performance feedback into an always feedback environment is that there really isn't that nudge or trigger to be thoughtful on an annual basis about a person's career and their career path and where they're going. And what you get into is a lot of more short-term reactive about how the last 2 weeks have gone. Not a thoughtful, you know, so I think there's a happy medium between more consistent, more regular, you know, feedback and the, and a nudge or a trigger for a really thoughtful, you know, conversation that's more strategic in nature.
Two things I want to ask. One is kind of going backwards because you mentioned briefly that there's seven dimensions of psychological safety, and we didn't talk about all of those. And so I don't know if all of our listeners know all seven of those dimensions. So I'd like to get that. But then I want to bring that back and then talk a little bit more about what you're just talking about, this behavior change, and get your thoughts on how technology is playing into that. Because I know you guys are doing a lot of work with that component of it. So maybe we take a step back and just talk about those seven dimensions and then bring that back forward into some of the technology aspect of this as we're going.
Sure. I think the easiest one to start with is discussing the seven factors around psychological safety. And there's actually an assessment that we use. And so it's seven questions. And the first is, if I make a mistake, it is often held against me.
Okay.
The second is, I'm able to bring up problems and tough issues.
Mm-hmm.
The third is, people sometimes reject others for being different. Mm-hmm. The fourth is, it's safe to take a risk.
Okay.
The fifth is, it is difficult to ask for help. The sixth is, no one would deliberately act in a way that undermines my efforts. And the seventh is, my unique skills and talents are valued and utilized. And so this assessment is what the Google team used. Wharton, I believe, has authored and open sourced this assessment. And so what we will do is we will ask these seven questions and on a scale, and be able to look at each of these dimensions on a scale of this happens regularly or this doesn't happen at all. And to look at that dimension on a scale for each of those seven factors.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for that. My second question was, again, around, you're talking about driving behavior change using BJ Fogg's model around that. How are companies integrating technology in this? I know everything today seems to be moving digital. How much of this can be moved into a digital format versus how much needs to happen in, you know, real life, face to face, or however else we're going to do that?
Yeah. Well, certainly technology and WeSpire's technology delivers these behavior change programs digitally. But what we're doing is trying to motivate and inspire people to change that behavior in real life, you know, so Right. So using technology to motivate and inspire a change that is taking place, you know, offline, often. Sometimes the things you're being asked to do happen online, but often it is to volunteer, you know, in your community or to make a donation. That is often more digital these days versus, but to, another might be to turn off the lights, you know, to save energy or to, you know, one in the area of psychological safety we're talking would be to notice when somebody's interrupted in a meeting and pause the meeting so that they can finish their sentence, you know, and those behaviors. So what digital does that is really, really powerful is you're able to organize the changes into essentially pathways and micro choices. And then you're able, in our case, to put game mechanics, social mechanics, personalization, feedback, recognition, sometimes rewards, depending on the company, around those behaviors. And so you're using the, you know, a template essentially of what we would call a campaign or a competition to increase people's ability to do something, but also to add in all those motivational hooks to get them to do it. And then all the communication based nudges and triggers to get them to do it at the right place in the right time once their ability and their behavior is optimized. So we focus in four different areas and run behavioral programs in sustainability. So getting people to save energy, waste, water, and fuel at work and at home. Social impact, which is getting involved in their community, voting, you know, community engagement, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, then well-being. And we take a very holistic approach to well-being. So it's, of course, fitness and healthy eating, but it's also stress and stress reduction, social, emotional well-being, and financial well-being. And then this last area that we work in is this inclusive culture space, where it's really raising awareness of everything from how to be an ally to implicit bias, to some campaigns that we've launched in the wake of the murder of George Floyd around anti-racist workplaces and really helping people understand the difference between being an ally and being actively anti-racist. And those are behavioral differences.
I go down those rabbit holes that get me going. So
you get three people who are passionate about behavior change in a room and you can geek out for hours. It is such an emerging science and such a... You know, we're such early days of behavior change and what works and what doesn't work, let alone how technology can be used for good in the area of behavior change. We've certainly have seen examples of how it's being used to not always be good, shall we say, in areas. But
yeah, but just on that last part, right? I mean, it's one of the things that we talk about a lot on the show is just the ethics of this marriage between behavior science and machine learning and some of the AI that's coming, just actually the ethics of behavioral science in and of itself as it gets more, and powerful is probably the wrong word on this, but this idea of can you use behavioral science for evil and even sometimes using it in what you think is a good or maybe just a ambivalent way that actually has some unintended negative consequences. And the fact of the matter is that I think that's only going to get more difficult moving forward because of the ability of how technology is going to be integrated with this, as well as the advances that we make in behavioral science. And so just your thoughts in general on some of the ethics that you think are going to play out and be important moving forward.
Yeah. So I think one of the most powerful chapters in a book about behavior science was Nir Eyal's chapter about the ethics in Hooked. And, you know, Hooked obviously is about the marriage of behavior science and technology. And he had a whole chapter devoted to the ethics of this. And, you know, again, let's bring us back to the fact we are in such early days. I can think back and I wrote what I think might be the first white paper ever in the history of the internet on behavioral advertising back in 1999 when I was the director of marketing for New York Times Digital. And we are one of the very first websites to do behavioral advertising. We would show ads based on your age, based on what you were looking at and all of this. And I had no idea what we were unleashing at that time.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. You know, and so, you know, I've been in this behavior space, but for my first 10 years in the industry, it was all about the commercial aspects of behavior and frankly, getting people signed up and buying subscriptions to news. So we were saving journalism. So that was good. But, you know, we were also getting people to click on ads and buy things through these techniques. what I saw in my next 10 years, and I transitioned from the New York Times company to starting and founding WeSpire right at the cusp of this, was social media. And what social media as an ad-supported media that had two things. First is a treasure trove of data about us that I could, you know, that we would have never had that level of data at the New York Times. And we had a ton of data. You know, we didn't know who all your friends were. We didn't know, you know, what you were saying to them and sharing about the exciting things that were happening to your life. And so it became an incredibly powerful media for connecting people to commerce. Then what we've learned is that people realize that there's commerce can also be ideas and thoughts and opinions and all of this. And I truly don't think in the early days that the major social platforms really understood how their ad systems would get manipulated for changing people's thoughts and ideas about who would be elected or what the power structure of a country should be. They just didn't see it coming. Whether they've responded effectively since that's happened, we could have a whole different show on that topic. But I don't think they realized the power of what they were going to do because nobody had ever done this before.
Yeah.
We now know that what we are doing is both good and bad. You know, we now know that there are things happening in games that are not great for kids. And we know there are things happening in games that are great for kids. We know there's things happening in media and social advertising that are actually good for people. We know there's a lot that's happening that's bad. So, you know, what we all have as designers and developers of these systems and these tools upon us, I do think is a moral and ethical question we have to ask ourselves each and every day. How is this system being used for the betterment of humankind? And how is this system being manipulated in a way that could hurt humankind? And I just don't think we're good at asking that second question enough. And, you know, as a founder and a designer of a system, you know, that is very powerful at driving positive behavior change, I'm super proud of what we've done. But I'm also aware that in, you know, if we weren't really focused on these four areas that are very good for people and society and the environment, could what we built be used for other things? Probably. So how do we make sure it's not, you know, and how is every company thinking about that? And I that's why I think it's just such early, you know, days on this. And we just need to be mindful that we're going to all keep learning an extraordinary amount. And, you know, and then this is where I get to the policies and the practices side of things. And I'm going to go back actually to an equity example on this, of where regulation is sometimes good. One of the most important pieces of regulation that benefited me was Title IX. And I am and was a college athlete because of Title IX. And if I had been born even 5-6 years earlier, I probably would not have been, because it was a piece of regulation that basically forced equity upon a fundamentally inequitable process of funding sports in schools. And it opened up, therefore, the opportunity for women to play soccer and softball and all these things. And many more women became athletes as a result of that. And so to change the system, we really did have to change the policies and the practices and the regulations around the system. And so as we learn more about behavior and how technology and behavior is connected, how powerful it can be, how it can be used and leveraged with data and media, I do think we're going to have to come up with a regulatory framework. And the choice is going to be the industry figures out an appropriate regulatory framework for how these things happen, or government's going to have to do it. And, you know, I would love to see our industry come together and come up with a code of conduct and a code of principles for how we do things. But I also know that that would be in a very complicated process. And I do think that one of the things that is happening as big tech is being hauled in front of Congress is there's some very smart people at the government level realizing that we probably need to do some things differently, knowing the consequences of a completely unregulated environment in this space.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the four pillars that your business is built on. And I'm wondering, kind of given this conversation around policy, around ethics and morals, is there any part of these four pillars that you feel are underrepresented or undervalued in the market today?
Yeah. So it's interesting for us because we started with the sustainability pillar and really running sustainability engagement initiatives for the world's largest companies. And then when the UN SDGs came out and created a much more unified framework where the sustainable development goals are not just about climate, but they're about health and well-being and equity and innovation. You know, we saw our companies beginning to see these things in a more unified way, and therefore our platform needed to run their programs in a more unified way. And it's a much more robust, exciting, wonderful, and effective, frankly, platform now that all four of those are together. And certainly the advent of everything related to COVID-19 has put health and well-being front and center, and safety, and everything happening in the world of racial justice and equity is putting inclusive culture front and well-being. The thing that worries me is that if we think what's happened in coronavirus is bad, just wait until we're 2 degrees centigrade higher than where we are right now. And I just worry that we are not focusing enough on climate in our corporations, in our towns, in our communities. And certainly we've had an urgent emergency, but the size of the size of climate change, relatively speaking, I think the best cartoon I saw was, it was two boxers in the ring, and it's a boxer fighting COVID-19. And there's this climate change boxer outside the ring that's 10x the boxer in the ring sign, who's getting ready to come over the, you know, the wires. And so that's what I worry about, is that it's not that it's taken a back seat. I think it's just, we're not moving fast enough, given we've got very little time left to make these changes.
Well, and climate change has the problem that we know from behavioral science is that it is a long-term impact for behaviors that we're doing today that we don't necessarily correlate the two together. It's the hyperbolic time discounting, all of those factors that come into play.
Terrible problem for how the human brain evolved.
Exactly. Yeah. So coronavirus, you see it, you know it, and however you take people and their belief systems around it and thinking it's a hoax or not, but you know, there is an immediacy to it. And so there's that getting into the ring. And I think part of this is actually, I think a different cartoon could have been where, you know, we're fighting in the ring with coronavirus, but there's another ring with climate change in it, and we're not even in the ring because it's just so far away.
Well, and climate change also has this other problem that you all know is a real issue with behavior, which is it's invisible.
Yeah.
You know, you see the symptoms, but you can't actually physically see the problem. You know, if you could just wave a magic wand and all of a sudden every time carbon was emitted, it was pink. We would realize the scope of this problem, and you would be able to look at the scope of your own personal problem and all of that. But the fact is that it's an invisible, you know, an emission is invisible. It has these horrible impacts, but you can't physically see it in some cases. Smog is the only, you know, sort of in the manifestation of the air gases, you know, the one thing. And so I wrote a blog post about why seeing the Himalayas matter. And it, you know, there's nothing we're doing in coronavirus that's going to solve climate change, even with a short-term drop in emissions. But what I did think is that the ability for people to visibly see the Himalayas who hadn't seen them in 20, 25 years is inspiring and motivating. It says it can be done. It says this problem is solvable. It reminds us of what it looked like before we had this problem. And I do think that's powerful for behavior changes that need to take place. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you think about a couple things that have taken off in the world of climate and climate mitigation strategies, funny enough, Priuses, you know, really took off in the early days as hybrids because they were so physically and visibly different looking than other cars. So it enabled somebody to say, see, here's my values. I care.
Signaling.
Exactly. The other are things like solar panels. Once one person puts up solar panels in a neighborhood, the likelihood of other neighbors getting solar panels is much, much higher because you can physically see and then go, you know, increase your ability to do it by asking your neighbor how they did it and how much it cost and all these things. Your motivation is like, oh, if they do, I can, you know, and the social norming around it happens. And so one of the things we've tried to do with our platform is bring visibility to invisible behaviors. Because if I'm choosing local organic chicken, it doesn't look different on that plate than that regular factory chicken at all. But if I get to say that I switched and I'm now, you know, getting my local chicken at a farmer's market and feel really proud of that, and people can congratulate me for doing that, I've just brought visibility to what people would not have seen. Or if I've turned down my water heater, or if I've put insulation in my walls, nobody would have seen that. And therefore I got no positive feedback, no motivation therefore to do it, you know, not anything that would really happen. But just by bringing visibility to these changes people are making, there's the opportunity for all the kudos, the congratulations, the recognition, the feedback that we know will then inspire more changes.
Yeah. We could nerd out on this for another several hours, but I have to ask, what's on your playlist?
Do have in addition to Irish step dancing, a streak for Irish music, but being from Boston, Dropkick Murphys shipping up to Boston is playlist, of course. Yeah. I also just love to dance. And so admittedly, the first song played at my 50th birthday party was Dancing Queen.
Oh, fantastic.
That's good. I'm just curious, music is important to you, it sounds like. Do you ever listen to music while you're working?
Not as much. And part of that is that most of my day is spent listening or talking to other people. So most of my music listening happens at the end of the day or on the weekend when I am in the kitchen and baking or cooking something, or if I'm going for a walk, or if I'm, you know, practicing dance at the end of the day.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Cool. Susan, absolutely wonderful talking with you. Just pages of notes here, which is always a really good sign. And my thing, I'm like,
thank you.
I just want to dig in more deeper. So, but thank you for your time and for your insights. And we are just super, super happy to have you be a guest and appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is really, really fun, because as I told my team, I could talk about this for months. Fortunately, it's a short podcast. So yeah. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Welcome to our grooving session, where Tim and I groove on what we learned from our conversation with Susan Hunt Stevens, have a free-flowing discussion, and whatever else comes into our ethically primed brains.
Absolutely. I love that.
Ethically prime brains. Because it was the last thing we kind of talked about with her.
Okay.
Some musical, you know, crap that you always do.
No, fantastic. Yeah. She's a Dropkick Murphys fan. I totally dig that. But let's talk about ethics first, because that is really, really important, right? If we don't, as practitioners, pay attention to the ethical implications, I think we're just missing the boat.
Honestly. Well, I think we've talked about this in multitude of episodes, right? So the idea that we can continue going down this road without a code of ethics or without something else that is going to guide us, I think is a little bit silly. I think we need to have something in order to make sure that we are doing behavioral science for good and not doing it for bad. Yeah. And the way of looking at that, right? I mean, I loved her, how she talked about how designers and what designers need. And she said that, what is it that designers need to ask, how is the system being used for the betterment of humankind?
Yeah.
But then the corollary, right, which is the other aspect of this, is how is the system being used, or how could the system be used for the detriment of humankind?
Yeah. Yeah. Because guess what? Everything that we do is going to have unintended consequences, right? Mm-hmm. It's very possible that we're creating for good and bad at the same time.
Good and evil.
I thought that you were going to, you know, put your little finger up to your mouth like Dr. Evil. but
my cat is in here and I'm stroking the, anyway.
You're actually feeling kind of groovy and not very evil right now. You don't look very evil. Okay, but all that said, we are living in a time when there are many, many challenges when it comes to designing ethically sound applications, initiatives, and interventions with behavioral science. And Cass Sunstein published a really great piece on this, kind of going through how to nudge for good specifically. Mm-hmm. And it's a good guide, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But gosh, we really need to be careful about it. The one thing that I wasn't super excited about is when Susan suggested maybe there's a need for a regulatory framework for behavioral science, you know, some kind of the community could create a code of conduct. I like the idea of a code of conduct. I'm not super wild about trying to create a governing body or a regulatory framework.
I think the difficulty is the expanse of behavioral science, the ways that it can be used and how it is getting implemented across. And again, from a practitioner perspective, I think you're talking from HR to marketing to advertising to incentives that we do into policy from a governmental agency, from political, you know, campaigning. So when
it's super broad.
It's super broad, which is fantastic, which is part of the greatness of behavioral science. The hard part then is how do you create something that is applicable across all of those fields? As we always talk about, context is important, so context matters. And it may be that we may need to have something like that in the future. I just hope we don't have to. And I wouldn't want to be part of having to try to figure it out, because it seems way too complex for this little ethically primed brain that is not up for that task.
That said, it's important that we consider. I'm glad that we talk about it as frequently as we do.
Well, and I do like, so she did mention again the chapter in Nir Eyal's book called Hooked.
Yeah,
rhymed. Yeah. But it was of and I haven't read that for years, but I do remember that. And the idea of using this, particularly in product design, is, you know, you got to really think about what you're doing and how that is impacting the end users, and not just is it lining your pockets. So, all right. So we got ethics out of the way. So now the rest is just downhill, right?
Well, yeah. We still have some topics that are really near and dear to my heart, and for me, the next big thing is the psychological safety.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk music. I don't know. There you go.
Well, again, she's a Dropkick Murphys fan. I think that it's pretty much all we need.
Okay, psychological safety.
Yeah.
Let's get into psychological safety.
So the work of Amy Edmondson is terrific, and I'm really glad that Susan and her company have embraced it so strategically and so emphatically. And it's really cool that that she can use just this simple 7-question survey, you know, based on Amy Edmondson's work from Harvard, that really just highlights this is a great way of coming to how are we doing. Get a quick assessment of how's the organization doing? How's the team doing? How am I doing? How am I feeling? And in a very simple and straightforward, it's a very efficient tool.
I'm going to go over them really quickly just so people can hear them and they don't have to search for them. All right. So, the 7 questions are this. 1, if you make a mistake on this team, it is often held against you. That's a negative correlation, obviously. 2, members of this team are able to bring up problems and tough issues. All right. 3, people on this team sometimes reject others for being different. Again, negative correlation. 4, is it safe to take a risk on this team? 5, is it difficult to ask other members of this team for help? Negative correlation. And 6, no one on this team would deliberately act in a way that undermines my efforts. And finally, the 7th question, working with members of this team, my unique skills and talents are valued and utilized. Fantastic model, fantastic way to try to uncover how safe your team feels. So as a manager, you can put a quick little survey together. You can ask those questions to your team, get that feedback and take it in and assess how well you're doing on that.
And it's culturally specific, right? It's going to be all if you're doing this in an organization that has offices in Mumbai and New York and London and Sydney, it's still going to be culturally relevant. because you're talking about the team that you work with, you're talking about the organization that you perceive, and it's important to get this kind of feedback. I think Susan referenced the idea of the 360 is so important to raise awareness and to point to, well, here's some challenges that we have. And it can be very specific. It could be within specific parts of the culture and within specific parts of the organization.
Well, and you brought this up, though, too, is the hard part about administering this isn't the actual administration of it. It is the acceptance of it from a leader perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. The idea that while it's an easy test, survey to administer, it can be difficult to hear that feedback if it's different, right? And if it's not what you want to hear. And so you have to be open to the possibility that your team isn't necessarily feeling psychologically safe, even if you want it to be or think it should be.
I was impressed by the example that she gave about the after-hour social event when she was talking about how some employees weren't really enjoying these after-hours events for a whole variety of reasons, right? But maybe at the core of it, what I took away is that maybe the days of the company saying, look, this is how you play the game. This, if you want to get into the good old boys club, this is what you have to do. I think that those days are, if not over, they're swiftly moving away from us. And that it's time to think about how to be more inclusive within your organization, to basically have a bigger table for the team to sit at than to say, well, if you want to be in, you're going to have to rise to this crazy standard.
But Tim, that's the way it's always been done. How could we change that?
Yeah. It's great, right?
No, there's some fascinating elements of that where we go, it's hard for, I think it could be hard for some people to hear that, right? It's like, why is going out after work a bad thing? And it's not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
But it should not be the thing that is gets you promoted versus somebody else because you have formed these relationships with your senior manager. So you have to think through and go, all right, are there people on my team that have families that might be more introverted that are in a situation where they can't go out after work? And so how do we include them? How do we make sure that they have the same opportunity to bond and belong that everybody else does? And so you're absolutely right. I think the world is changing and the ways that we used to do things are not the way that we're going to be doing things in the future. And COVID by just its nature has kind of jump-started that in ways that we weren't necessarily thinking either.
Susan Cain's book, Quiet, comes to mind on really pulling out this idea that not everybody's an extrovert. You don't need to be an extrovert to be a leader, to be innovative, to be clever, to be thoughtful, to be strategic, to be a great contributor to your team. You can still be an introvert and do all that.
And part of that conversation we talked about is being a facilitator. As a manager now, it's this aspect of facilitating these conversations and facilitating these interactions and these engagements. And so you have to be able to listen and to understand who on your team isn't speaking up and who isn't adding to the conversation and figure out, is it just a bad day for them? Do they want to be this way? Or is this something that maybe, you're not providing the right environment for them to be able to be part of that conversation? And so facilitate the opportunity for them to participate and to add value.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, the role of the manager is changing.
Well,
it's not the way that we've always done it.
I was never a good manager anyway, so.
Well, you're still managing, so.
Yeah, maybe in this new world, I'll do better.
Maybe.
All right, so anything else on this, Tim?
Just the diversity of teams and the importance of having diverse teams. It certainly ties back into the Project Aristotle stuff with Google and psychological safety, but I liked how Susan talked about, we tend to think of diversity in terms of gender or race, but it's more complex than that. And it needs to be culturally appropriate based on your organization and your teams. I thought that was just a really good takeaway.
I liked her when she talked about the hypothesis on what drives success in those three categories. Mm-hmm. The demographic, is your education background, et cetera. Is it the sense of self, mm-hmm. right? Your training mentor, all that kind of stuff. Or is it behaviors, extroversion, et cetera. And the only one that they found was, hey, if you have a stay-at-home spouse or partner, that's the only one that was led to any kind of correlation to success. So
yes, yeah. The old paradigms are just gone.
Yeah.
You know, they're just gone.
Well, and it reminded me actually of, I read an article, I don't know where, never saw something, maybe it wasn't, but it was, I hired a wife and it led to my, you know, to me being successful. And I don't remember the full thing, but I read that the title and I probably misquoted that, but you know, I'm going, oh, this seems weird, right? What is it? And it was actually a woman who, you know, went out and she hired herself a wife to do all of the elements at home. So she didn't have to in order to, you know, make that happen.
Wow. Okay.
Which again, it goes back to the stay at home spouse or partner piece, right? And so it even gets to the point of, you know, can we offload that? Is there, and again, I'm not saying we offload our spousal duties or different things,
no.
But all of those factors, I think part of that is like, you're not stressing about getting home to clean the house, to make dinner, to who's doing what with the kids. Are you planning their time and you know, camps and all of the other factors that go at this? So, you know, what of those factors can you outsource and can you do that? That might be part of what can then lead to success for you.
Anything else?
I'm just excited to hear, you know, this bonus track.
Okay. Well, folks, stick around for the bonus track. It's coming right up. Hey, Groovers. This is Tim with the bonus track and groove idea for the week. Susan Hunt Stevens engaged us with her energy and practical focus on how to help companies apply behavioral science to improve their culture, productivity, and profitability. We discussed how teams can be more innovative and productive when their members are diverse. While we typically define diverse as women and people of color, the application is more nuanced and is really context dependent. That led to talking about one of my hot topics for the past several years, and that's psychological safety. Susan shared a simple 7-question survey developed by Amy Edmondson at Harvard to assess each employee's perspectives on psychological safety at work. It's something that you can take to your own organization to assess what areas need the most improvement. Lastly, we talked about the importance of the ethical application of these very powerful behavioral science concepts. She calls practitioners to task in the development of new products, new campaigns, and new communications. She asks, how will this be used for the betterment of humankind? Kurt and I are calling on you to take action with this groove idea for the week. We'd like you to take the 7-question survey on psychological safety. The 7 questions are in the show notes, and we would like you to think about them in reference to your work environment. Don't respond in black and white with yes or no. Respond to each question on a scale, with 1 representing, say, the very poor description of your experience and 7 being an excellent description of your experience, and ask yourself, what needs improvement and what is working well in your current position? As always, we welcome your thoughts. Send us a note or drop us a message on Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook or Instagram. And while you're at it, please leave us a quick review. It goes a long way in helping other people find behavioral groups.